What a story it has been to follow. First, Sony made a movie in which the fictionalized leader of North Korea is assassinated. Then Sony gets hacked and North Korea is blamed. Theaters are alarmed and Sony pulls the film from its Christmas release. Then they change course and the movie, The Interview, came out in independent theaters yesterday. This whole saga brought cybersecurity to the forefront of national security conversations. Turns out there is a global underground market where people trade in malicious code and where you can find the tools needed for an attack like the one unleashed against Sony. These markets make it relatively easy to attack a global company and make it hard to trace the perpetrators. Here's Steve Henn from NPR's Planet Money team.
Mark Rogers is a principal researcher at the computer security company Cloudflare. He's been tracking the attack on Sony for weeks, analyzing the code the hackers used.
This is Windows malware. It's fairly sophisticated, it's very complex, and it's modular. It's made up of lots of different bits.
Rogers says the attackers took one piece of code from one place, one piece of code from another, and snapped it together, kind of like a Lego set. Some of this code is malicious, some is legit. But the FBI believes this attack was carried out by North Korea because some of these bits of nasty code have been used by North Korean hackers in the past. But Rogers isn't completely convinced.
The malware world is really incestuous. You've got people who share source code, who borrow things like hacking tools or even commercial pieces of software.
And these bits and pieces of malware are bought and sold in a global underground market. Hackers who trade here can build their own unique attacks by snapping together parts that other groups have developed. Rogers says he knows Russians who will sell a complete malware attack right off the shelf.
They'll sell it to you with a subscription. When the malware is identified successfully by antivirus, they'll update it for you so the antivirus can no longer detect it.
It's kind of like software as a service, but for thieves. And it's not just criminals who are buying and selling computer attacks on these gray markets.
Typically, the U.S. government pays out higher than anyone else.
Chase Schultz is a computer researcher. Researchers like Schultz spend their days searching for ways to pick the digital locks which are intended to keep all of our machines safe. When they find a key for a lock like that, they can sell it.
If they were to sell that to another government or that type of thing, they, you know, could potentially sell that for, you know, hundreds or tens of thousands of dollars.
But Schultz says most researchers and hackers don't sell directly to government agencies. Instead, people like this usually sell their attacks to a small global network of brokers. In a sense, these brokers are the arms dealers of the digital age. They act as go-betweens, connecting researchers or hackers with buyers like governments and organizations who are searching for backdoors into computer networks.
You can take a exploit to one of these people and they will go forth on your behalf.
An exploit is like a key to a digital lock, and selling these things can be a lucrative business. But Schultz says it's also ethically dicey.
The other thing I have to wonder, too, with some of these brokers and vulnerability markets is, are they double selling?
Researchers like Schultz say after you sell a computer vulnerability on this gray market, you can never be sure exactly how it will be used or where it will end up. Steve Henn, NPR News.
Many of you opened gifts today that were bought with a tap on a mobile app. Got us thinking about a business model NPR's Elise Hugh looked into a few months back. While online sellers rely on the ease of smartphones and tablets, some have also been opening physical stores.
On this bustling corner in New York's Soho neighborhood, you'll find what was once the Bowery subway station.
And actually, right here, we have the staircase going down to what was the subway.
Today, Joe LaPadula rents out this corner spot to a retail company selling pants at 40% off. Other days, this space serves as a test kitchen and bar, or it hosts showrooms for press events. The one thing this place doesn't do is anything permanent.
Pop-ups, or this idea of selling something for a temporary period of time, has been around since human trade has been around.
So what happens when human trade is over the internet? Boom times for more temporary physical spaces. An industry is springing up around pop-ups. LaPadula works for Open House, a company that owns storefronts in the always fashion-forward Soho and rents them out for retail, promotional events, exhibits, whatever clients need.
As long as they can change it back, they can do whatever they want.
Leases can last as short as a single day. or shorter.
Trojan condoms was the shortest, so it was about 20 minutes.
Los Angeles-based industry consultant Shama Maher has been watching pop-up retailing develop for the last half decade.
With food trucks becoming more and more open and available and kind of the migration of bringing that, I actually think that pop-up shops kind of followed suit.
As consumers do more and more on our mobile devices, the short-term leases promised by pop-ups mean brands can be more mobile too, moving around to where their customers cluster.
Larger online brands are bridging together these empty spaces and starting to find ways to get in front of their customers.
The old retail world meant long-established brands existed first in brick-and-mortar stores. Then they expanded online. Now, La Padula says the model is flipped.
And the business model is innovative in a way. And that's because you can now start a company on the internet, and then there's this intermediary step between a brick-and-mortar where you can pop up and have this tactile, real experience.
That clicks-to-bricks model, as the marketing folks call it, is exactly what happened with the eyewear brand Warby Parker. Dave Gilboa is one of Warby Parker's co-founders.
We're kind of learning as we go along.
They learned first by using their apartment as a showroom. They also experimented with a traveling bus full of frames. And they used pop-up stores as labs.
It was just kind of a fun space for us to really experiment.
What time is your appointment?
While you can easily buy Warby Parker frames without ever stepping foot into a store, and many people do, the glasses brand found many of its customers still crave a physical experience. So what were once pop-ups have become something permanent.
Right now we're in our Green Street store in Soho. So this is the first store that we opened.
Floor-to-ceiling bookshelves line the walls of this sprawling store, displaying alternating columns of books and the complete Warby Parker glasses line. Since opening this location, the company has signed two more long-term leases for New York stores. Co-founder Gilboa.
There's still something tangible that you can't replace when you're walking into a store, engaging all five senses.
The shopping options now before us engage not just all our senses, but all our spaces, real life and virtual. Shama Maher.
You're going to have a chance to experience brands unlike you have before, in your hands, in your face, and in your mind, and on your phone, all at once, all the time.
A lot for customers to consider. For the brands, experimenting with spaces that don't last can lead to a lasting business. Elise Hu, NPR News.
The U.S. government is still investigating the highly publicized cyber attack against Sony Pictures. The FBI accused North Korea of carrying out the attack, a charge Pyongyang denies. We do know the hackers were not happy about the new Sony movie, The Interview. By the way, we'll hear Bob Mondello's review of the film in a few minutes. First, the different conclusions some private security analysts are drawing about who hacked Sony. Here's NPR's Aarti Shahani.
The FBI says the attack came from IP addresses, unique computer identifiers, originating in North Korea. Scott Petrie, a network security analyst with the firm Authenticate, says you can fake an IP address from anywhere in the world.
The fact that the data was relayed through IPs associated with North Korea is not a smoking gun. There are products today that will route traffic through IP addresses around the world.
Like Pyongyang or Moscow or Baltimore. The FBI also says the hackers used malicious software, code, that's been used by North Korea in other cyber attacks. Petrie counters that in the world of cyber attacks, criminals are constantly recycling code. There's a well-known attack against banks called the Zeus Trojan that went open source, freely available to anyone, a few years ago. So when a financial institution gets hit, the same malware often shows up. Again, Scott Petrie says it's no smoking gun.
It's like saying, my God, this bank robbery was conducted using a Kalashnikov rifle. It must be the Russians who did it.
He says the FBI's evidence is circumstantial at best, and its public handling of the case is inconsistent with proper procedure in prior investigations. Petrie recalls back when he worked at Google, the search giant had evidence the Chinese government was trying to hack its servers, perhaps to mine emails from dissidents. The U.S. government, he says, counseled the company to keep quiet.
There's never been any firm public attestation that the Chinese were responsible for any of those exploits. And yet, in this instance, you know, the FBI comes out in a matter of days and says it's North Korea, case closed.
The FBI declined to comment on this skepticism, citing its ongoing investigation.
When you have any source attacker as a nation state One of the key goals that they traditionally have is persistence.
Himanshu Dwivedi with Data Theorem is another skeptic.
Which means staying in a location, obviously electronically, for a very long period of time.
Dwivedi has investigated cyber attacks since the 1990s. He's worked on cases involving nation-state actors big and small. And he says it doesn't make sense that North Korea would want to make a splash.
Because there's no motivation as a nation-state to communicate.
The FBI is looking at data that most of the world cannot access. But Shlomo Argaman, a professor of computer science at the Illinois Institute of Technology, took a look at data from the cyber attack that is publicly available, like leaked emails, postings from internet forums,
transcriptions of messages that appeared on hacked computers at Sony.
And Argaman did a linguistic analysis. Based on the writing style, Argaman wanted to identify the most likely native languages of the hackers. He considered four: Korean, Mandarin Chinese, German, and Russian.
There was some consistency with Korean, but much, much less, which indicates that although it's possible that these messages were written by people whose native language is Korean, it is far more likely that they were Russians.
Argaman only has preliminary results so far. He says before drawing a strong conclusion, he's got more analysis to do, and so does the FBI. Aarti Shahani, NPR News, San Francisco.
And this week, I've been talking to people about online activism, using social media sites like Twitter to advance a cause, start a debate, or keep one going.
For we will not succumb to threats.
The debate we're listening in on today comes down to this. Should ordinary Muslims make it a point to publicly condemn the actions of violent Islamic groups? In a speech in September, President Obama made his case.
It is time for the world, especially Muslim communities, to explicitly, forcefully, and consistently reject the ideology of organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
Of course, some Muslim organizations are doing that. A recent example, with the rise of the extremist group ISIS, one British organization started the campaign Not In My Name with a Twitter hashtag and video.
We must all unite together and try to stop this group from damaging Islam and damaging Muslims.
Not in my name.
But there are some Muslims who think these expectations are unfair. And some of them got behind a more cynical hashtag.
Hashtag Muslim apologies.
At Mamuha 2013, I'm sorry you tapped my phone, and all you learned was that I was planning a potluck.
At Smalzawalaya, sorry that covering my body out of modesty doesn't fit into your social stereotype of women.
At Fahad Haji Ali, sorry that our religion is just too cool to handle. Muslim apologies.
The person who helped launch this hashtag is Maha Hilal.
This hashtag illuminates a very divisive conversation in the Muslim community.
Hilal is a recent PhD graduate from American University and says the hashtag grew partly out of anger, partly out of whimsy.
I created this fake shirt saying I'm Muslim and I'm sorry for everything, and that was on one side of the shirt. And on the back it said in the past, present, and future. So to me, it was a joke. It was saying, like, no matter what, this is just a blanket apology. And from this point on, like, I don't want to have to apologize for anything else. This should just cover everything, right?
And, of course, she posted a picture of the fake T-shirt on Facebook.
And then someone who had commented said we should take this conversation to Twitter. And within hours, there were, you know, hundreds of tweets.
At Nada Production, I'm sorry that while Europe was in the Dark Ages, Islamic civilization thrived in technology and science.
At Rose 3, I'm sorry that Mufasa had to die in The Lion King.
At Elki Lani Maluna, as a Muslim, I apologize for World War I and World War II, even if it has nothing to do with the Muslims, but just in case.
At Coup Story Life, I'm sorry for existing.
Some of them were quite pointed. There was one that said, I'm sorry that Muslims keep getting in the way of your oil.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that said, I'm sorry we didn't quietly accept the puppet dictators that the West loves imposing on us. What surprised you about the directions that these went in?
You know, they're kind of being sarcastic in terms of, sorry, we're getting in the way of whatever goals it is that you want to accomplish in the Muslim world. So for sure, there was a little bit of a pushback in terms of what is the relationship between what's happening in many of these countries and the ways in which the U.S. is intervening.
You know, for people hearing these and at the same time maybe hearing news of extremist acts throughout the world, what is the problem with saying some horrendous act happening in the name of my religion is not something that I condone and I want to speak out about it?
Sure. I, for one, you know, when I see an act of terrorism on the news, I don't identify with the person. I feel nothing towards that individual using Islam as a rationale or justification. And I think that that's the way that other people from other minority groups or from other groups in general, you know, when crimes are committed by members of their group, how do they react? Would white Christian Americans feel any sense of responsibility or any need to speak out against a crime if an act of violence was perpetrated in the name of Christianity? No. I think that that's extremely problematic. And I also think, and I think a lot of Muslim organizations are guilty of this as well, there's not enough analysis of what's being done in terms of why exactly are these individuals committing acts of violence. Obviously, there's a global war on terror. Obviously, there's occupation. But it's always then just reduced to, especially in the case of Muslims, religion, and that's it.
There's also the argument that when people speak out, it's not necessarily intended to be an apology for all of Islam, that they're instead really expressing their own outrage.
I mean, I think, honestly, I've heard this counter-argument numerous times, and I just think that there's a very fine line in terms of condemning and apologizing. And again, I think it comes back to what is expected of Muslims and Muslim Americans, and is this expected of other groups? And I think the answer is no, it's not expected of other groups.
One thing you wrote in your essay in sort of explaining this is that you wanted to respond to this idea of kind of being held responsible for what extremists do, using cynicism and sarcasm as a way of fighting back. Mm-hmm. One criticism is that it's just that, cynicism and sarcasm. What is the value of that?
In a way, it's just catharsis, right? It's just a way of releasing all these pressures and stress, a way to say, like, it sucks, but this is how we're going to deal with it. And also, I think through these kind of actions, you find like-minded individuals who are not just tweeting, but who are actually doing actions on the ground, who are doing research, who are trying to transform their communities. You know, for me, I assumed, you know, a handful of people would also agree with my perspective. But then the evolution of this hashtag demonstrated to me, for example, that it's more than just 10 people. It's thousands of Muslims who are sick and tired of being held collectively responsible. And we could potentially, you know, connect with one another and figure out ways to constructively address this issue beyond Twitter as a platform.
Maha Hilal, a recent PhD graduate from American University, she helped launch the Twitter hashtag Muslim Apologies.
There are some good reading suggestions there, but you should think carefully about when to read them and what you read them on. New research says that combination matters. NPR's Rob Stein reports.
Lots of people like to read in bed before going to sleep. And more people these days are reading tablets, laptops, and other devices. So Anne-Marie Chang of the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and her colleagues decided to test whether doing that affects someone's sleep. It's been known for a long time that being exposed to certain kinds of light at night could disrupt sleep.
But we wanted to test if light from light-emitting devices, such as e-readers, which were gaining in popularity, would have the same effect if people were using them to read before bedtime.
So the researchers asked 12 volunteers to live in the lab for a couple of weeks. For 5 nights, they read what they considered to be relaxing material on an iPad for 4 hours before going to sleep. For another 5 nights, they read the same kind of stuff from an old-fashioned book. The researchers reported what they found in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
We found that when study participants were reading on the iPad, it took longer for them to fall asleep following, and they had shorter duration of REM sleep, which is a particular stage of sleep. They also reported feeling less sleepy in the evening, but more sleepy the following morning.
The researchers also discovered that the kind of light emitted from the iPad and other electronic devices was messing up a really important hormone.
They had decreased levels of melatonin, which is the sleep-promoting hormone that normally rises in the evening and peaks at night.
Chang says all this is a big worry because other studies have suggested messed-up sleep patterns and melatonin levels may increase the risk for some serious health problems.
for example, obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, certain cancers.
So Chang recommends if people want to read before bed, they should consider devices that don't emit light or just pull out an old-fashioned paper book. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Our tech team is with us to talk about the year in tech. NPR's Laura Seidel is in New York. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
NPR's Arthi Shahani is in San Francisco. Hiya.
Hi.
And NPR's Elise Hu is with me here in the studio in Washington. How you doing, Elise?
Doing great, thanks.
Each of you has picked a big theme that you've been following this year. And Elise Hu, since you're right here, let's start with you. What has piqued your interest this year?
Well, I'm always fascinated by the way we humans actually behave with technology. So this year I've been focused a lot more on this next wave of computing, essentially devices controlled by voice that are anticipatory, meaning they kind of know what you need before you ask. This holiday season, in fact, Amazon rolled out one of its anticipatory devices. They call it Amazon Echo. It takes advantage of these ideas. You put the Echo, which looks kind of like a cylindrical speaker, in your living room. Then you activate it by saying its name, Alexa. In fact, there's a demo where there's a family that's busy baking, and I've prepped some of that for you guys.
Alexa, add wrapping paper to the shopping list.
I've put wrapping paper on your shopping list.
Alexa, how many teaspoons are in a tablespoon?
1 tablespoon equals 3 teaspoons.
Okay. Alexa, set a timer for 8 minutes.
8 minutes, starting now.
Alexa's just, she's a bundle of laughs.
She can do a lot of different things at once. And of course, in 8 minutes, she will remind you that that timer is up.
Elise, I remain somewhat skeptical because I've had a lot of frustrating interactions via voice with computer. So have you tried it? Is it better than Siri?
It is smarter than Siri. And in fact, Cortana, which was Microsoft's answer to Siri, also improved on the original Siri. So part of our disappointment with voice in the past has been that it just hasn't been that great.
So, Elise, based on what you've seen from Amazon's Alexa and the like, what do you look for going forward?
Well, bottom line, our voices are just going to become a much more common way of interacting with our devices. These major consumer-facing tech companies are all moving forward in the voice realm. And the part about all this that's either convenient or creepy, depending on how you look at it, is that these microphones that hear us and we're speaking into will do much more than just accept commands. They're going to be listening to our daily patterns and from there generate insight into how we live our lives.
So my phone could tell me, you are late again, Robert. It could be doing that in no time.
That's exactly right.
And is it always going to do it in a female voice?
That's actually a huge criticism of this, right?
Really? Yeah, they're always women, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Siri, Cortana, Alexa, all women, and they all have names that end in vowels.
Laura Seidel, we just heard from you. You've been paying close attention to Apple, and they've had an eventful year with Tim Cook running the company. Tell us about Apple's year.
Well, I guess I would say that Tim Cook has been very closely watched because, of course, he is stepping into the very large shoes of the charismatic founder of Apple, Steve Jobs, who passed away 3 years ago. This year began with Apple shares falling 8% when iPhone sales were off and missed forecasts. Then in the fall, though, he released the iPhone 6, and it literally broke records for iPhone sales. But even perhaps on a social level, Cook bravely came out as a gay man in Bloomberg Business Week, and he has committed the company to being a more diverse workplace, although meanwhile he's been facing down Jesse Jackson, who's organized protests over the low wages of Apple's contract workers.
I gather, Laura, that one big product for Apple in the next year will be the Apple Watch.
This is big, right. We got a glimpse of it this year, and there is not an exact date for a launch, though Apple says it's going to be early 2015. This watch is really going to be a big test for Tim Cook. It's the first new product category that Apple has stepped into since the passing of Steve Jobs. Now, under Jobs, Apple reinvented existing products and popularized them. Take, for example, MP3 players. None of them really took off with the public in a big way until the iPod came out. The question now with this watch is, can Apple do the same thing? Samsung and Google have smartwatches, but people aren't that excited about them, you know?
Yeah, and so, I have to say...
Yes, Arthi Shahani.
Yeah, I'm actually skeptical that Apple is going to suddenly burst open some consumer appetite for their wearables. I know that there was a lot of hype around their event this year, and we're all waiting to see what happens next year. But, I mean, do you actually think they're going to do it?
I think the jury is out. And I think it is a big question because Steve Jobs was brilliant at figuring out what consumers wanted. And can the company do that without him? Jury's out.
Well, finally, Arthi Shahani, there's been a long list of hacking debacles this year. You've been looking at that. What's the big threat out there for average people?
Well, I mean, chances are, if you're listening, I don't have to tell you that every few weeks in 2014, we heard about some credit card hack in a store that we know, Staples, Kmart, Super Value. Around Black Friday this year, actually, BB, the women's clothing store that I shop at, got hacked too. And it's not just bad luck, right? It's technology too. According to security experts, just about every single retailer could still get hacked the way that Target did. And you know, one finding that I found remarkable in the process of reporting is that when we, NPR, called out to the major retailers and we asked them, hey, are you at least spending more money on IT security? The answer that we got was dead silence. They weren't even willing to tell us on the record.
What do you sense about consumer behavior? That is, do we think that it changes radically after a huge story that Target has been hacked? Elise, you wanted to say.
That's actually a really good question, Robert, because what I've been writing a lot about on AllTech, the blog, is that we have a sense of sort of hack fatigue or data breach fatigue, right? This happens again and again and again, but we don't really feel the consequences. Consumers don't, right? Because the banks tend to pay for
the
hacks of our cards.
Mm-hmm. And the data actually shows that sales are up. So, you know, it's not just that from our own experience we see ourselves shopping, but the aggregate data is saying the same.
Arthi, do you think this year, though, that there will be the kind of hacks that consumers will really feel, for example, identity theft?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly in that direction that people are going to start to care a lot more. I mean, the credit card hacking, Elise, as you just said, ultimately it's the banks, the financial institutions that pick up the bill, and we just get inconvenienced with having to get a new number. But with identity theft, it's a lingering problem. So, you know, like take the Sony hack. You know, it's not just that the company has to worry about its movies getting pirated. The company lost the social security numbers of more than 47,000 employees and actors like Sylvester Stallone. And then also on a larger scale even, healthcare data is getting stolen a ton. There have been a couple hundred big hacks reported to the government this year, and there was that ginormous one with community health systems this year, 4.5 million patient records breached. And, you know, think about it just for a moment. Someone takes your daughter's social security number and opens her first bank account before she gets to, or someone gets prescription drugs on your name and drives up the cost of your insurance. So there are a lot of repercussions that are lingering. You know, when a credit card number gets stolen, the real victim is the agency that has to pick up the bill. But when your identity is taken, it can't just be replaced with 16 new digits.
Well, Arthi Shahani, Laura Seidel, and Elise Yu, thanks so much for giving us your analyses of the year in tech and what's ahead.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.